of our laughter ringing the air. Oh, wherever the time goes, I will see you there.
The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end? And where go the echoes of our laughter ringing the air? Oh,
this is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. I am just one of the two hosts for this public affairs show about Dearborn and the surrounding area. Dennis Reimars, our WHFR News Director, is with me. Good afternoon, Dennis.
Good afternoon, Jay. How was the farm market this morning?
Oh, it was fantastic. Obviously, good weather. Everybody's
perfect.
Out there. It does continue every Friday, sponsored by HFCC and Oakwood Hospital, all the way to the end of October. So the last last Friday in October 28th, I believe, that will be the last time it's there for this year. But we must have about 25 or so vendors out there. And here's a story from DearbornPatch.com to get the show rolling that actually talks about the Dearborn Farmers Market, something that I didn't notice when I was there. But supposedly there are pink baskets that are rolling around that market and also at the Wyandotte farm market.
And we saw those last week as well, yes.
Oh, okay. So here's the story, folks. Project is from dearborn.patch.com. Project Produce, as it's called, seeks assistance to continue at the Dearborn Farmers Market, not only for the month of October, but for next year, too. Think about this if you'd like to do a volunteer work here. The Farmers Market devotees in Wyandotte and Dearborn may be used to seeing some distinctive pink produce carts filled with donations of fresh food. The carts belong to Project Produce, and the food in them goes to help feed families in need. They have a feed need for feed. In Wyandotte, the produce goes to the local Salvation Army soup kitchen and to the Wainwright Community Meals Program. In Dearborn, the produce goes to women and children starting out fresh through the domestic violence program at First Step of Michigan.
Awesome.
And we have another story here about First Step. There has been a few organizers and activists here at HFCC in the last several years that making First Step their number one commitment. We'll talk about that in a moment.
All right.
The Wyandotte Project Produce began last year as a branch of the program that began in Dearborn, brainchild of Sandra Bolton.
We know Sandra Bolton, don't
right,
we?
Right, the PR person for the Dearborn, Friends of the Dearborn Animal
Friends
Shelter.
Friends of the Dearborn Animal Shelter, excellent.
And also Sherry Duquette, that's Duquette. And it seems that Sandra and Sherry are both owners, because it says owners with an S, of Solstice Designs. That's their day jobs.
Jewelry, I think.
Okay. And here's a quote from Bolton. It was an extension of what we were doing. The initial concept was to make jewelry to give to the children in the domestic violence center to give to their mothers on Mother's Day.
That's cool.
It was a way to empower children to be able to give their moms a gift. Duquette wanted to be able to, quote, help nourish their souls, unquote. For 6 years, the jewelry designers at Solstice Designs have given necklaces to the children at First Step, more than 400 all totaled. Wow, that's a lot of necklaces.
Yes, it is.
And last year they, but the problem is, think of how many people at First Step needed them,
right,
to help make things seem better. We'll get it, as I said, we'll get into that. And last year they decided to continue nourishing them through fresh food. Okay. The way to a man's heart is through the stomach, if not everybody's spirit through there. You know, if you're hungry and starving, you're not thinking about too many good things, and you don't have a lot of, I guess, wherewithal, gumption, energy even,
right,
to better your life and to make changes.
Well, you're distracted. Sure, yeah, you're thinking about where you're going to eat.
Well, of course. Bolton said they've left everything behind. That's why they're doing this. And she says Project Produce was a continued outreach. So this is how it works. Produce from the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market was donated by vendors and by shoppers. So the vendors would give it free, I assume, and the shoppers would just buy something and, mm-hmm, and give it from their carts, who saw the pink cart and added their ears of corn, cucumbers, tomatoes, and other fresh locally grown food. Bolton said it was very well received. People were even donating from their own gardens. It took off like wildfire last year. So I guess people were coming by, with food from their gardens and then dropping them off at the pink carts. Natalie Rankin, director of Wyandotte's Downtown Development Authority, saw the pink cart at the Dearborn Market last August and thought it would be perfect for the farmers market in Wyandotte. She said, I knew how giving the people of Wyandotte were, and I knew it would work. I had no doubt in my mind. So, to sum up here, just the success last year, okay, and I didn't see these pink carts before, I'm sorry, or I would have mentioned the program so everybody would understand. Last year, from the Dearborn Farm Market alone, everybody donated collectively nearly 1,600 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
1.6.
That's almost a ton, isn't it?
Yeah, 2,000 is a ton. 1,600 pounds of fresh, locally grown produce. This year, however, the pink cart has been missing from the Dearborn Farmers Market. That's why I didn't see it. You said you saw it.
I did. I swear I saw it last week. Unless maybe what I saw is they had those carts there. I saw carts.
Okay, well,
that doesn't help you, does it?
We saw them last. We were there last year, so maybe right, you saw them last year and just thought it was it. Anyway,
as I get older.
So yes. Sherry and I can't manage for the entire Friday this year, and we have been able to organize volunteers. We haven't been able to organize volunteers this year. We like to set that up. The donated food also needs to be delivered. Somebody has to deliver it to First Step.
Right.
And that's another problem here. We need a volunteer for that. Like at 1 o'clock, somebody has to drive all the food over from the cart. This is one way in which we can help families while they're rebuilding their lives, while encouraging healthy eating together and enjoying local produce. There are a whole lot of people who need it. And so for information about this, let's see, since it's especially needed in Dearborn, I mean, you can look up First Step of Dearborn, folks, and First Step of Michigan,
right,
and get information that way. But also in Dearborn, 313-724-9400, 313-724-9400, or on the web, send an email to give@projectmothersday.com. So that's the two ways to find out about, and this is called Project Produce.
And then Project Mother's Day was probably the jewelry, so they kept that email.
Right.
Got
yeah.
it. Mm-hmm. Great idea.
Okay. So where'd the First Step come up here? We got to, in radio it's called Segway. We got to go from one story to the next. Here it is.
Seamlessly.
Okay. Also from dearborn.patch.com, one of our key sources in Dearborn.
Absolutely.
They were just doing a little follow-up, and since we had Jessica Carreras, who's the Dearborn...
She's the editor.
.com editor,
sure,
on the show, she said they were going to follow up with some sort of specialized stories about the crime report. There's a federal crime statistics for 2010 all across the country, and there was a story in the Press and Guide about the basic details. Certain violent crimes were up and others were down. I'm sad to say that this week there was national publicity about the five worst violent crime cities in the U.S.
We're number one.
Detroit is number one again. Murder capital again, as well as other violent crimes. Even though we were down from almost 400 to about 350 from 2009 to 2010, but the percentage was up because there's fewer people in the city,
right,
and this area since it moved away. So even though the numbers, the actual numbers are down, the percentage is up. And also on that list, sad to say, Flint, Michigan was number four.
Yeah.
So I didn't know anybody was still in Flint, but yeah. I guess one murder in Flint would make it pretty high percentage. I'm just kidding. But they say everywhere that Flint is one of the dying cities in the U.S., and I don't know how long it takes before everybody goes away.
Well, was there a Buick? Buick is gone.
Right. There isn't any factory jobs of any significant number in Flint. There's still the University of Michigan Flint.
Right.
I don't know how many students they have left, so that's a fine institution, but I'm not sure what else is happening. Obviously, people live there, and people have to provide services for the people that are living there, but without a lot of tax base from a big factory, it's going to be pretty expensive to stay living there. And I remember they had that, was it called Auto World or something? It was a big expo, sort of fun park that they tried in the 60s or the 70s. And that failed in 2 or 3 years. It was a big dome, and they had like sort of like Greenfield Village rides and info interactive things all about cars.
Seems pretty cool.
Yeah, of course, when you stop making cars in Flint, and it wasn't that much. I mean, it was a good, well, they tried to redevelop their downtown area, and it just, nothing's worked for them. Michael Moore had it in his first documentary, too, where he was trying to find the CEO of GM, looking for Roger Smith that was called. And he had a time in Flint when Ronald Reagan came to campaign there. And while he was campaigning, it seemed the way Roger Moore did it, and he was criticized for this, but he juxtaposed two things, that in a particular pizza place in downtown Flint, Ronald Reagan was in the banquet room making a speech about things, about, you know, how we can revitalize the world and that, and out front, somebody was robbing the cashier at the same time. So
isn't that called Roger and Me?
Roger and Me, thank you. Yeah. Okay, give credit to it. It was a fine documentary, but because he juxtaposed things a little bit, he didn't get an Academy Award for that. He did for Fahrenheit 9/11.
But yeah, and they did modify the parameters of the award based on that.
Yeah, they,
because before it had to be a very pure thing, could not be like you
opinion
said,
oriented,
right? And so right, on. And no other
seemed
kind
like
of
it's straight objective facts,
sure, and observation, whatever.
Right, and I'm glad they changed the category. Yeah. Okay, so so Jennifer Carreras wrote the story here about Dearborn Police and victim advocates reflect on the 46% jump in one of those violent crimes in the Dearborn area in Dearborn, which is reported rapes.
Right.
Reported rapes, and rape is, of course, a violent crime. Mm-hmm. It went up from, what are the numbers, though, even though a 46% increase, there was 16 reported rapes in 2009 and 14 more in 2010. Now, it does say further down the line that it looks like it's decreasing this year, though, already. Now, the Dearborn Police, though, think that part of the issue here is that they've worked very hard, according to Chief Haddad, on encouraging people to report assault and all crimes. You can't solve the crimes or find the criminals unless you know there was a crime committed, first of all. But secondly, you've got to realize they're going to try to make sure that you're not embarrassed or you're not further victimized by the report. And so first step is the organization that is helping the Dearborn Police, providing a shelter and services for survivors of domestic abuse and sexual assault in Wayne County.
And isn't sexual assault, rape, isn't that one of the one of the biggest crimes that goes unreported. I mean, I know that there's a humiliation factor. There's a lot of things that go into it.
Right.
And so by encouraging this and with First Step taking, you know, doing their part, it seems like more people will come forward. Mm-hmm. And that may be, is that what you're saying? That may just be the case.
That yes, that's, that could be why the numbers seem to be up. There may not be more occurrences. We don't know for sure, but we know it was underreported for years.
Right.
But I wanted to emphasize here that if you have been the victim of domestic abuse or sexual assault in Wayne County, contact the police department in your area. First of all, they will then work with First Step. First Step, even 2 years ago, they implemented what's called the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program, which served more than 160, as they call them, survivors,
sure,
just in the first 10 months from their creation in 2009. Police departments such as Dearborn's refers many of those victims. So that's medical assistance as well as emotional and psychological support through individual and group counseling programs, and temporary shelter if you're afraid to go home or something. So things are being done. Things are much better. And you should report these violent crimes, rape, domestic abuse, if they go on. And you need to have help. You need to stop that chain of violence, either in the domestic situation or, you know, other people.
Yeah, even if it's random, you have to.
Well, there's a last point here is that rape itself happens mostly, 75% of the reported sexual assault victims are assaulted by someone they know.
Sure.
So family member, supposed friend, relative, whatever. So I guess it's safe to go on those blind dates, relatively, because that's only 25%. Still could happen if you don't know the person. But
if you've met,
I'm not suggesting picking people up at a bar just because there's less percentage of a chance they're going to attack you. But I'm not saying that, because that can certainly happen at any time. I would think you'd want to know the people you're associating with, especially intimately, for some length of time.
But well, you've met my wife. You know, if I went on a blind date with another woman, that wouldn't fly.
Well, that would be domestic abuse right there.
Right there.
And maybe you deserved it. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? But I'm just saying, and also, of course, the other characteristic is, besides the people who know each other, within the other 25%, there's been an increase in what they call adult actors with victims under 17. So there's more adults who are doing sexual abuse for more people under 17, not just people over 17. There's been a slight increase in that. It doesn't say how much.
Right.
But I just want to emphasize that a program is in place. As I think I suggested, that the numbers, like the 46% or even the murder capital rate of you know, being number one in the country, this is not something you should be that concerned about overall, especially with political times coming up. If a candidate says, oh, we got to do something about the terrible crime, blah, 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 crime is decreasing, even in these difficult times, even with the numbers looking like they're getting slightly higher by percentage,
right,
that doesn't mean that crime is increasing that much, because remember, there's a lot fewer people in this area. They're
sure,
leaving, you know.
Everything's relative,
there's
sure
reasons for that. I would like to take a six-minute break here, in fact. Well, I'm taking the break, but you're listening, right? Because Stephen J. Dubner, who is part of Freakonomics Radio, was interviewed on an NPR show called Market Report, and it is available for our station to use here, just for 6 minutes. We actually used one of his shows this last Monday on the Monday Forum from 6 to 7 p.m., and that's available if you missed it on our website, whfr.fm. Click on Talk Shows, click on Monday Forum, and whatever the Monday date is it's labeled as Freakonomics Radio.
So is this from the author of Freakonomics 1 and 2?
Yeah, he's the he and his colleague, Mr. Levitt, Stephen J. Dubner, is usually the host of the radio show, but Levitt and Dubner are the two authors of the two current Freakonomics books that are out there, which applies economic theory to the very practical, pragmatic, everyday life. And it's not what you think. The numbers,
right,
if you look at it, are not the commonly held beliefs or myths about things. And one thing is about violence here. So take a listen. He's talking on Market Report about the decline and fall of violence. And so I just think that on commercial radio and commercial TV, that's usually the lead stories, the top stories, the constant stories about how much crime there is.
Sure.
Well, they have to dig to find it now because it's not as easy as before. There's not, well, take a listen to Dubner. He does a much better job than I do on this. Okay, here we go.
Hey, Freakonomics podcast listeners. I've got a confession. We've been two-timing you. Been doing segments on some other guy's radio show. I can't live with the guilt anymore. So here, just go ahead. Put him on your iPod. I feel better now.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
It's time once again for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio. Every couple of weeks, we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. This time, though, a special treat, the other co-author, Stephen Levitt. Gentlemen, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, Kai.
Great to be here.
So, Dubner, you are not in New York. You have gone to the city of Big Shoulders, Chicago, with your comrade there, Mr.
Levitt. Yeah, I've come out to Chicago to try to persuade Levitt to run for president, because I thought it'd be fun.
We have a guy from Chicago already, you know.
Well, I know, but, you know, we've talked before on this show about how the president of the United States doesn't really matter that much, so I figure even if Levitt stinks, it wouldn't be any great loss. And unlike most economists, he'll admit that the president can't control or even predict the economy very well, but there are some useful things he actually does know about. For instance, what causes crime to rise and fall?
All right, Levitt, do tell. What do you know? What do you know about crime?
Well, let me start by saying I absolutely, categorically, am not running for president.
I don't think you have to worry.
If
about
nominated,
that.
I will not run. If
That's
elected,
right.
I will not serve.
That's right.
When it comes to crime, one thing that I think I know that many people seem not to know is that crime has gone down, way down. And while many people are haunted by the thought that crime is high and rising, it categorically is not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, contrary to popular belief, the world is a more peaceful place today than literally at any time in history by a long, long shot.
I'm going to need something better than long, long shot. Quantify for me, Dubner.
All right. So the Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker has just published a new book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Huh. And he argues that our rosy view of history is pretty much entirely wrong.
In tribal societies, hunter-gatherers and hunter-horticulturalists, an average of about 15% of people met their ends through violence. Huh. In the 20th century, if you try to come up with the highest estimate you can, combining all the wars, all the genocides, all the man-made famines, you get to about 3%.
So that's 3% of non-natural, right? I mean, people who met their deaths by other means, right?
Yeah, violent, and he's including there, you know, man-made famines, famines caused by civil war, whatnot. Yeah. And keep in mind also, in the 20th century, we had mechanized weapons, so killing becomes easier. That early violence was carried out in much more rudimentary ways. Here's Pinker again talking about 16th and 17th century England.
Samuel Pepys in his diary talks about going to the town square and watching a general being drawn and quartered. And in the next sentence, he talks about going to a pub and having some oysters. It was such a routine part of his day. In the era of Henry VIII, I think 10 people were executed a week.
Ouch. So, Levitt, what's the trend, though? I mean, America in 20th, 21st century, how are we doing?
Well, we've been doing pretty well lately. There was a very auspicious trend from the 60s to roughly 1990 with crime going up and up and up. But over the last two decades, crime in the U.S. has fallen in half.
How come?
Well, I think there are really three factors that explain most of it. And the first is just we've dramatically increased the prison population. There are now 3 million people behind bars in the United States, up from maybe 500,000. We've hired a lot of police as well. That's another factor that matters. And a third factor people think a lot about and that seems to be important is the rise and fall of the crack cocaine markets and the violence associated with that. The rise in the late 80s led to a lot of increase in crime and then the decline with the falling apart of those markets. And I have my own pet theory, and not that many people agree with me, but I do think the data support it, which is that the legalization of abortion in the 1970s led many of the people most at risk for crime never to have been born. Mm. And so when they would have grown up 20 years later, they just weren't here to do the crimes.
All right, but Dubner, make the connection for me between a lousy economy and crime, because you'd think it would go up.
You would think. And even though the evidence argues against it over and over again, smart people still think that it will. So crime actually fell during the Great Depression when the economy was in the toilet. Now, that was in part because Prohibition had ended. Crime spiked during the 1960s when the economy was booming. And in this most recent recession, despite a lot of predictions to the contrary, violent crime has continued to fall against really, you know, all the smart money bet against it.
If there's one bet you know you will win. Yeah. It is a bet that the next time that crime falls when the economy is bad, the headline of the New York Times article that talks about crime falling will say, in spite of everyone's prediction, because of the poor economy, that crime would rise, crime has fallen. It's, you can see the same sentence written 14 times by the New York Times.
Levitt, let me ask you this question, though, because if you go out there and ask people today, ask 10 people on the corner of the street outside my studio here in Los Angeles today, they will probably say that year over year, crime is getting worse, and yet your data shows it's not. What's that about?
I think people in general are terrible at assessing risks, that we very naturally overestimate dramatic things. So come to death, as an example. Things like airplane crashes or terrorist attacks are very vivid and attract a lot of attention, whereas we systematically understate the likelihood of dying from those kind of deaths, which are slow and silent and involve wasting away. Those don't make the headlines, and so we don't really think of the risk associated with, say, eating way too many cheeseburgers the same way we do as being shot out of the sky by missiles hitting airplanes.
Freakonomicsradio.com is the website. Stephen Dubner, Stephen Levitt, thanks, you guys.
Talk to you soon, Guy.
Hope you enjoyed that segment from Market Report, which is a National Public Radio program that's on part of the morning news, I think, every morning. And it's usually like 7:50 to 8 o'clock in the morning. And apparently they have Stephen J. Dubner on every month as a guest, just to spout off a little bit. But he has his own separate podcast. And as I said, we featured it just this last Monday on the Monday Forum from 6 to 7 p.m. And it is recorded on our website in our archive, whfr.fm. But you can also just subscribe, as they call it, if you go to the iTunes Music Store under podcast instead of the music. Most of the podcasts are free. This is information about science and politics, and some of it is a little scandalous, but most of it's pretty well chosen. It's not the internet spectrum per se. It's pretty well chosen, responsible commentaries, and you could get it automatically delivered to your own computer. In fact, Freakonomics Radio is approximately once a week now. It didn't used to be, and the segments are about an hour long. So you will hear them featured on Monday Forum as long as we have space for it. We hope to continue developing more local talk shows and filling it up with that hour with local talk shows. The fourth Monday of each month on Monday Forum, I'll conclude by saying, is Parent Connection. That's a locally hosted show by Margaret King Ahmed, talking about issues having to do with kids and schools and parents and how we can all work together and solve problems before they become problems, maybe.
Preventive medicine, sure.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
So wait, so you obviously listen to the podcast, right? Because that's 7 in the morning. I don't...
Oh, 7:50 is the Market Report thing, but
right. But you listen to a recording of it, right?
I don't listen. That's the Market Report where Dubner was the guest.
Gotcha.
He's not on every.
All right.
Every they just said at the beginning of that segment that they invite him over about once a month, and they sort of gave him the whole segment this time,
right?
To talk about the decline and fall of violence. So don't be as afraid of violence as some of the numbers would indicate. Nothing wrong with driving to Flint or going to Detroit. Of course, there are certain neighborhoods at certain times of the day, but every city will pretty much say that. I thought it was kind of interesting that one of the most dangerous cities in the U.S. is Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah, that was on the list.
That's number five, but it's after Flint. But
well, obviously, fewer people live there than, say, Los Angeles
right.
or New
well,
York.
Well, it's easy to have a high percentage if you just have a few crimes.
Right.
You know, so, but
people should use common sense, but mm-hmm. don't be afraid to do something because of some statistics. Sure.
Okay, let's turn to the papers here, just to make comments too. The Press and Guide from last Sunday has many, many stories. Five stories, did I count? About medical marijuana,
yeah.
Just a big issue, of course, in Michigan. Voters voted in favor of allowing it, and then there was these. Call them dispensaries.
Sure.
Places where you could buy it if you had a prescription from a doctor, but then some of them started getting a doctor, like right there, and they just sort of listen. And if you say, I can't sleep at night, though, or something, you know, I'm very anxious,
yes,
aren't we all, they'll give you a prescription. So there's some practices that sort of stretch the idea of the law.
Sure.
There's some, and one of the articles in there. So the whole Sunday, October 2nd press and guide is about five stories in it. Not the whole paper is not all in, but there's one on the headlines, and there's two on page 3, and there's one on page 13A. And the one on 13A is the one that actually gives you the legitimate medical reasons for prescribing marijuana to smoke in order to alleviate pain, usually associated with chemotherapy, by the way. And it's it is a very good way to ameliorate pain and suffering. I don't think it's a curative for any disease offhand, but there's no other way to effectively treat some of these situations other than prescribing medical marijuana. So great job. J. Patrick Pepper wrote the story on the front, of course, and he is the key soul reporter for the Press and Guide full time.
Key and soul, yes.
Yeah. And perhaps he organized finding the other stories that are also there about how the moratoriums, which is what we have now in Michigan, because a judge here in Michigan said, oh, you can't really do it because federal law doesn't allow it. Okay, well, that's got to be worked out. I notice in California, the federal government is cracking down on medical dispensaries of marijuana again, even though the people of California said it was okay. I mean, the government's putting all this time and money in this. And folks, it's my humble opinion, not necessarily that of Henry Ford Community College, but the people that need it to treat terrible symptoms related to disease and dying should have access to it. They definitely should. And whether or not you believe it should be legalized or decriminalized, there's a difference there. I won't go into it. That's up to you. The people of Michigan, I think, have already spoken, and democracy, and we say it's okay. And so I don't see the federal government wasting time and money on this minor drug when there's so many major, addictive, harmful drugs still circulating. Although, don't get me started on this, the big drug war has not worked out too well at the federal level in terms of drugs coming into this country from other countries. So that's another.
It drove the price up. That's all it did.
You would know, Dennis.
Well, I read a lot.
Oh, okay.
The one of the things that I do remember this, and tell me if you do. Didn't Obama say that if in regard to the medical marijuana that the federal government would not impose upon the
would not prosecute the states or something? Well, they changed
apparently. Can they do? No, I'm just kidding.
They can change enforcement of laws one day to the other,
sure,
however they feel like it, to whatever the seems
appropriate. So I do remember that correctly.
I assume Obama doesn't want to, in the last year before the election, have the Republicans use that as a talking point against him. Oh, he's in favor of drug use, more drugs, more marijuana.
Right.
Might get him more votes. Who knows? But it just doesn't work. Both the big drug war hasn't been working, and also the little drug war, trying to crack down on these dispensaries that, for the most part, have been voted as the preference for California, Michigan, and some other states, too.
Sure.
Well, we're just looking into there. I'm just saying, good for them. It's not exactly investigative reporting, but it's in-depth coverage from several different points of view of one public issue for the state of Michigan. And so it's good. Congratulations, Press and Guide, for doing that. I just want to switch from that to say that they have been recognized, as they put on their own cover page, front page from last Wednesday, October 5th. They have won 11 awards as being a great newspaper here in Michigan, Michigan Press Association. They have an annual Better Newspapers contest, and the staff of the Press and Guide earned 11 awards ranging from spot news to sports and photography, despite being moved to a higher category class and competing against larger newspapers.
Congratulations.
Last year, the Press and Guide won in Class B. This year, it won in Class A. So A, what's in that category? Is that the news and free press?
And don't you wonder?
Well, you can't get any bigger than Class A, right?
So
it's got to be, if they say it's a bigger category, it has to be the big category, the all-inclusive one for the biggest papers. They mention former photographer Millard Berry. Remember, Pepper told us that their Pulitzer Prize quality photographer, full-time photographer for years and years, that he had been laid off.
Yeah.
He had been fired. Now, I still see photos by him in various sections. Maybe he's freelancing.
Sure.
You know, paying him per photo or something.
Wouldn't you go with him if you needed photos, you know, as a freelancer?
Beautiful. And he's been rewarded here, and I'm sure he has been in the past, too. And they've got an example of one of his firefighting photos, fires being fought there on the front cover. And it just shows the quality of the photo and the excitement. And just like a sports photography, he's just gotten into sports photography in the last 5-6 years,
too. That's tough, too.
That's a tremendous challenge, and he's just great. He's just a great photographer, and of course, they fired him from his full-time job. So I hope they feel really bad about that. But they are, but they did win top honors in three categories. You got three awards for best news picture, best feature picture, and best sports picture. This is for all of Michigan in the category that probably competes with the
news and free press.
News and free press in Detroit, right?
Wow,
just unbelievable, and of course. Staff writer J. Patrick Pepper took home two awards himself.
Of course, of course.
A third place, for a story, a spot news story on the explosion that took place in West Dearborn neighborhood, and a first place nod for an enterprise news story he wrote about how a local man helped do something that's continued, so I don't know what it was. But anyway,
congratulations
to Millard Barry, and because they got 11 awards, more than any other paper in the category, they also got named Newspaper of the Year.
Well,
The Press and Guide, Dearborn Heights, there's a couple other editions, but it's basically what you see in the Press and Guide. So congratulations to them. Job well done on a shoestring.
Hey.
But that's the one problem I have about reporters. Remember, Jessica Carrera said this too. Said, reporters now have to take their own photos.
Sure.
Well, I'm sorry. I've taught photography, videography. I know what composition is. Automatic cameras can take decent pictures, but it's not always well composed.
Right.
In fact, there was one shot in one paper, I won't mention which one, a couple of weeks ago. There was a lecture event happening, a panel discussion happening, and we get a shot, badly composed, of somebody sitting in the audience.
That was
the photo they used for the story. And the audience, it wasn't that they were all applauding or standing ovation. They're just sort of sitting there, dumbfounded. Now, they identified one person who was sitting in that audience group, but it seemed... Well, number one, bad composition. Number two, didn't make any sense to use that. I mean, the story was about the people up on the stage.
Right.
You know, the main speakers. And didn't see them at all. Maybe it's the only photo they had, but why use a photo then at all? I mean, absolutely. So I've noticed a decline, and with all due respect to Patch.com, most of their photos are not that well composed. I did see the ones done, just because I looked closely at them, though, for the... Adopt-A-Watt event that I was at, and those
right.
were really well composed. Of course, the idea is take a whole bunch of them, but know what good composition is and good exposure, and just choose the best, of course.
Yeah, and there's ways to take it, like you said, a picture of a crowd or whatever, to make it look interesting.
But you need to take a class. You need to study.
Sure.
You need to have a professional guide you into better photography, and I'm sorry to say that the general... journalistic photography has declined in quality, but not Millard Barry. Oh, no, not Millard Barry. And so keep up the good work, people. Nice job there.
Very nice job.
Okay.
And of course, we'll only have, you know, Patrick Pepper on the show because he's so competent. You know, I saw Millard Barry a lot at all of these events, Homecoming when we were out there, mm-hmm. as well as the farm market pretty regularly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, when you're full-time, that's what you do. You spend every day going out with your camera, taking pictures, and keeping, I don't know, police scanner or whatever else on.
Yeah.
And ready for tips.
Plus,
you've got
sure
a list of events in the city that you get from one source or the other. So it is a full-time job if you're really going to do it well. And you have to have the right equipment. It usually has several cameras.
Right.
You know, so if one goes down, you've got long lenses, so you can use that zoom to get in there if he has to. And there's all kinds of ways of needing to be a professional photojournalist. And, you know, a part-time person just can't know enough, learn enough, and do a good enough job, I'm sorry to say. There was a bad trend about 20 years ago that some of the TV stations, even in this area, said, we're going to have a new kind of news coverage. We're going to have a one-camera news team, video news team. The reporter will have to set up the camera on a tripod and get out in front of it and turn the viewfinder on so they can sort of compose and make sure they're standing in the scene. They remote control start it, and they do the interview with with the person standing next to them. And there's no what's called B-roll to see their face clearly. It's a flat sort of thing. And then they come back to the studio and they have to edit it themselves. So you have to, well, that didn't work out. They said, well, we'll pay them twice as much if they do all those four different jobs. And it just looked terrible. It was just awful. And so they have come up with other systems. But that's why the CBS affiliate in Detroit has not really gotten into news coverage, because they were going to do it with, oh, one person reporter is a big deal 20 years ago. Yeah, nobody wanted the job, first of all. It's too difficult. And what you produced wouldn't be good for a resume because it looked terrible.
Right.
You know, there's no way you could do a good job in all those positions. So great business idea, but not very good for electronic communication. Okay, I thought it was the most entertaining or interesting. For the folks in Dearborn Heights out there, we got several stories, several things to tell you. So listen up, Dearborn Heights. Okay, you're listening out there? I know our signal goes really well all over your whole city. Okay, besides the once every 3 months special show, interview show that Ned Apigian hosts, which won't be on again until the end of November. Ned, of course, is one of your Dearborn City Council persons right now, running for re-election. I should say, and Dennis, you've got the schedule, we are actually going to talk to the challengers.
Only the challengers. City
Council. The reason we only do the challengers, and sorry, incumbents, sorry, Ned, but you already have your name out there, and you have your record out there, because, you know, if anybody reads the papers, they know what you did, they know what you said, and the challengers don't have easy access to that or even to fundraising. So as we have done in most elections, we try to go for the challengers, or in the somewhat bigger elections, the partisan elections, we go for the smaller parties, the Green Party, Libertarian Party, or at least the party that doesn't currently have the incumbent. So we actually have those interviews. When are they coming up, Dennis? Do you have the schedule now?
I do. I have it in front of me. A week from today, we'll have Kathleen Abdelhak will be joining us for 20 to 30 minutes in studio. Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks after that, on the 28th of October, we'll have Lisa Hicks Clayton, also a challenger. Mm-hmm. And then on the last Friday before the actual election, which would be November 4th, right, Scott Craig will be in studio with
okay.
us.
Okay, and we're going to give them about 15 minutes each, but to ask them similar questions. It's not a debate, folks. They can go on for 5 or 6 minutes if they have to explain a point about who and what they are. So we'll put that on our website as we get closer to it. But for next week, Kathy Abdelhak will be our interview guest, and she is one of the three challengers, along with two incumbents, of course, running for only two spots on
actually,
the Dearborn City Council.
Five people for three spots, yes.
Oh, five people for three
so
spots.
So there's three challengers, two incumbents.
So one of the challengers has to get in.
That's what it looks
least.
Like, yeah.
Well, good for them.
So maybe they'll
get if somebody moved to another place, if Janet Battelow leaves,
right,
that would open another spot.
That's why she's running for city clerk.
But if she doesn't win...
Well, I think her term is over.
Oh,
I believe I don't have that sheet in front of me, but there were, when I looked at the number of people that were leaving, were three spots.
But that's what we try to do here, alternative ideas, and we'll get interviews with the Dearborn Heights City Council challengers. There's no Dearborn City Council election coming up this November on November 8th, so that's why we're not interviewing them. And in fact, we decided to go with Dearborn Heights. Okay, the clerk candidates.
Well, I do stand corrected.
Something else, Dennis?
Well, I was going to say Battelow's term ends the 31st of December, 2013.
Right. So I think if she doesn't win the clerk's election, then she's going to continue her own term.
Right. But the terms that will be ending are for Elizabeth Agius.
Aegis, I think.
Aegis, thank you. Kenneth Barron, who is the city council chair, and then, of course, Ned Apigian.
Oh,
so
okay.
Those three
so
spots.
Three.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Nope, that's... kind of what I thought, but you know, this show you have to listen all the way through the new WHFR Journal, all the way to the end. I mean, we had a show 3-4 weeks ago, and I apologize. We corrected ourselves three times on one issue in the course of those 60 minutes.
Right.
So it's a little embarrassing, folks, but we eventually get it right, or pretty right, or as right as we can get it by the end of the hour. So you don't dare tune out because we might do a correction or an update even during the show. That's just the way we roll around here, trying to get things right. We could just say anything we want to and not correct ourselves. And
yeah,
how
that didn't work real well.
No, somebody's bound to send us a nasty email about
that's right.
that.
Or
It's very embarrassing when you get things wrong. All right. What about that debate? Well, two stories. You can look at the Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday. City Clerk in Dearborn Heights, Pruzowitz and Battalo. And that story is on 5A. And it's not there. Okay.
Really?
What is that? I got the wrong paper? Oh, I got the Wednesday. Okay, Sunday. I won't mention the advertiser, but for a couple of weeks now, a local bank has been advertising full-page ad in the Press and Guide, and it's printed. The ad is printed upside down.
Well, that got your attention.
And that's been
it?
Going on for. I thought it was just a mistake the first time, but it's been going on now for a month. So, but do you think I'm going to mention their name over the air? No, because it's probably intended to get more attention.
Right.
To print it upside down. I'm expecting soon that the whole paper will be printed upside down to get more attention, but. That would be too easy. You just turn it around, and then everything would be right side up.
Well, so. Then they couldn't charge more for ads because they'd all be
okay.
upside down.
Well, here we go. This is the forum that that happened on the 28th. League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, hosted it. In terms of the clerk candidates, just two of them, they debated. And several of the issues were, well, first of all, Walter Pruzowitz, is currently a city clerk, but he's only been there for a few months. He talked about his 30 years in government, most working for the county, master's degree in business management, his experience managing other people, and running, of course, the city clerk's office so far. And Janet Battalo, who's been on the city council, she actually has degrees directly in finance and accounting. She ran restaurants for a time and has served on the city council for 10 years. So I think the voters know of her and her positions pretty well, but how will she do as a full-time city clerk? And it's interesting, this story here from Katie Herrick at the Press and Guide, while the debate was mostly cordial, Pruzowitz used his closing comments to shoot down Battalo, saying that when the entire clerk's office left last spring, she did nothing as a council person while he stepped in to fix problems. That her election as clerk would create a vacancy for the new council to fill, and that it would be a waste of taxpayer money to train a new person to do the clerk's job. So I guess their city charter would demand an immediately filling of her position. And I remember in Dearborn Heights, it's not like Dearborn. You can't go back to the last election and take the next
person
qualified
that didn't win.
Person.
Right, right, right. How do they do it there?
Oh, they have to have a special election within two or three months.
Well, that
it cost them a lot of money.
Sure.
They were thinking of changing that, but... They haven't at this point. So he makes that point, but that doesn't have to do with really who's better in that. It's interesting that Battalo then declined to shake his hand after the debate.
No, you wonder? You wonder why, right?
Thank you, Katie, for that little detail, because that's sort of the human part there.
Yeah.
He waited till his conclusion to actually attack her.
Sure.
Otherwise, they were just giving their own individual responses to the questions rather than...
Well, you don't want to give somebody else a chance to come back, right?
Well, no. I guess he had pulled the final straw, and of course, the last thing you hear is what sticks in your mind the most. So.
Right. The last thing you see is no handshake.
Now, the League of Women Voters, they're going to have videos of that and probably this one that happened in Dearborn on their website. I don't know if it's there already or will be there soon, but their website address is lwvddh.org. That's League of Women Voters. Don't use the of. ddh.org. So lwvddh.org. And that's a great resource. There will be, of course, a general voting guide that should be out shortly. They said October, and so maybe it's in your local city clerk's offices at Dearborn Heights and the city of Dearborn. You can just pick one up, and that gives you all the candidates, all the issues, and sort of an explanation of what's going on. But to see these videos might really be that extra human touch to see what these people look like and sound like and how they respond to different issues. I haven't seen an updated picture of Janet Battalo. I'm sorry to make a comment about this, but she has been campaigning with a picture that must have been from 10 years ago.
Seriously?
Yeah. Of course, Ned Apigian, he's got, I think his, when he came out of the Marines, I think he's got that picture on.
Right.
Along with the current photo, too.
Let's hope so.
Carefully staged. I mean, he's a distinguished gentleman, but I'm just saying, you know, you can't tell too much by a photo, and the newspaper's photo shows what these people look like more. Usually.
Did they have a special election when he?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I remember
and
that.
And he ran against Kathy Abdel-Hak.
I remember that.
It was just the two of them for filling in that for that 11 months, 12 months, whatever, right. And he won, and she didn't, but she's running again, so that's okay. Well, we'll see what happens.
Good one. She'll be on the show next Friday.
There's also a story that's somewhat in-depth on that same candidate forum, and that's great. That's in the Dearborn Press and Guide from this last Wednesday. Dearborn Heights is hosting a number of, as long as we're talking about Dearborn Heights here, and why not, they hosted a second town hall meeting on the 26th of September, and that's reported in the Times-Herald in detail, about, of course, their millage increase, right. Almost 3 mils. Dennis and I talked about that last week, and the reasons for it. We'll talk to, of course, all the Dearborn City Council candidate challengers and ask them how they feel about that millage increase, too, and the necessity for it. Looks like from the story, I'm just summarizing here, especially City Council people, Marge Horvath and right. others, we don't get this. We're really in trouble, and I think the city of Dearborn would say the same thing. If those basic millage of almost three mils, 2.95, I think we said last week, increase in Dearborn Heights, and in Dearborn 3.5 for the general fund, another 1 mil request is in there, separate proposal for the support of the Dearborn libraries. Although they really need 2 mils, but 1 mil would help. And those are both on the Dearborn ballot, 3.5 and the 1 mil, as well as that Civil Rights Commission issue. Okay, interesting in the Press and Guide on the 5th. Let's see, and we've got a number of stories to finish up with. So in 5 minutes, Dennis.
All right.
Yeah, interrupt me.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, you know, and
normally
folks,
I wouldn't give him permission.
Right, folks, you heard that. He did tell me to.
Yeah, okay. So wait for that. see how that works out.
It'll be fine.
It's kind of funny. The lead story on the Press and Guide from this last Wednesday, Dearborn Survey asked voters what they want. And it's interesting that the lead-in, the hook line, people really like living here, says J. Patrick Pepper in his summary, but they're less likely to recommend it to their friends than residents of other communities would for theirs.
Interesting.
Whoops.
What?
Why wouldn't we recommend living in Dearborn? Well, I would say for young people, there's not much to do. Okay, we got a few bars in West Dearborn.
Sure.
We got a couple of restaurants. We don't have a movie theater. The Performing Arts Center does not have main stage activities, but then again, maybe young people don't go to live theater. I don't know. You should. Shame on you if you don't. But the artists are not chosen for them. They're chosen for people closer to their senior years.
Sure.
Or in their senior years. I guess they've been making money on that. I don't know. I think attendance has been down. But I know the mayor has been concerned that they should have more things going on at the center, both on the main stage and elsewhere for younger people of the city, but that hasn't really
really changed. Some of the they have the Oak Ridge Boys there, somebody like that, which is definitely for an older crowd.
Yeah, country artists from
right, and that was just
30 years ago.
But that's my point. And so maybe if they targeted the younger crowd, but I don't know. I don't mm-hmm. know.
Well, Dearborn, at least, they're trying to say we use many tools. There's just one of many. We're trying to find things out about what people like and how well they like us.
When you said no movie theater, you meant outside of, like, at Fairlane there is.
That's not more than alternative theater.
Right, know, that's what I thought you meant.
Something that's really going to be a special attraction.
Like what they have up in Traverse City. You keep talking about that being an excellent model.
Right, yeah. And we had a theater in West Dearborn, which unfortunately burned down.
Oh, yeah.
Showcase. Rumors of arson by the owners so they could get a easy way out. And I just said rumors. And just, you know, but whatever it was, nobody decided to rebuild it.
Right.
And now it's Buddy's Pizza. That's the location.
That's where it was?
That was where the theater was.
Boy, I did not know that.
Yeah. And that extra land between Buddy's and Bryant, some of that was also for the movie theater.
You're talking about where the farm market is. Huh.
Yeah, and the parking lot wasn't really there at that time either.
No kidding.
And it was a great classic, like a... probably was built in the 20s or the 30s, and it had sort of, it was like a mini Fisher Theater.
Maybe it looked like the old Penn in Plymouth, similar? Kind of a,
well, it was nice. There were balconies.
Yeah.
I was in there a couple of times.
That's cool.
Before I moved to Dearborn even, but we lost it, and it's too bad. It could have been programmed in an alternative way or like the State Theater in Traverse City that Michael Moore programs, something more like the landmark Main and Maple Theaters mm-hmm. in Birmingham and in Royal Oak. And it's not that they, I mean, even the State Theater, Michael Moore's, they have the latest Hollywood pictures, but they only have them for like 2 or 3 days. And then they have another big picture, and it could be foreign, it could be a documentary.
Right.
And they have a lot of specials and like 25-cent admissions for seniors and all kinds of community-related projects oriented around that, and a huge number of volunteers.
Right.
And that's how they can do all that stuff for free. And it's a wonderful facility, and we could do that in Dearborn, but we don't have the building. I mean, just don't. It cost a fortune to build it, so oh well. And looking at that survey, the poll was conducted by Lansing-based Cobart Community Research, and that's a nonprofit that works primarily with public entities to conduct such surveys. The cost of the poll was not immediately available. And this is how they did it. They got answers from 2,000 residents via mail through two separate mailings in June and July, and they only got 501 responses. They think it has a plus and minus 3.8% margin of error. Okay, so I wasn't one of them this time. I did participate in a survey, the last one, about the direction of Dearborn. That's where the bike pass got in there.
Right, I figured. Yeah, but, I heard your voice when I read that.
Yeah. But they say it's, you know, all the statistics say it would be valid for our whole city, give or take 3 or 4%. And blah, 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 and it just, here's the five key takeaways from the study. Dearborn ranks well when compared to the benchmark studied, compared to other cities. So health, safety, police, you know, and we rank well. There are several areas where improved performance would have a significant impact, including community events, economic health, city government management. Ooh, city government management. I wonder if that's the building and safety departments. Oh, well. Public schools. Public schools came in for some criticism.
Right.
And diversity, whatever that means. I mean, we have many different kinds of people here living here. Do we need more?
Maybe they're thinking of the separation because there is a big separation between East and West.
I don't know. I think we're getting along pretty well these days.
Right, right.
Even in the high schools where there used to be a lot of conflicts between different groups of students.
We're running out of time here.
Yep.
So, okay.
More than 50% of respondents would support a millage to offset police services. More than 70% want to see a light rail station.
Well, there you go.
We're going to have a train station.
Congratulations.
What they mean by light rail, I mean lighter rail than regular rail. Where they want to go. They want to go back and forth to Detroit or Plymouth on a smaller line. I don't know what they mean by light rail. We're going to have the new train station. And briefly, look in two different stories, patch.com as well as Press and Guide from this last Wednesday. Michigan is going to purchase more high-speed rail. And so we're getting closer to get to Chicago at 110 miles an hour.
Well, we can go to this is targeting Kalamazoo, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
So from Dearborn to Kalamazoo.
Okay.
I just want to talk a week from tomorrow, October 15th from 12 to 2. This goes on every year at Fire Station Number 2, which is 19800 Outer Drive. It's just north of Michigan Avenue on Outer Drive. It's an event for everyone. It's Come and Meet Your Fire Department, the annual Fire Department Open House. They're doing free hot dogs and drinks this year. That's provided by Allstate, free face painting.
Great. The fire department has free hot dogs.
Oh,
hot dogs.
Boy. And then they have the beverage to put it out. You can look at and climb on the fire truck, spray the fire hose, which sounds kind of whatever, but this is a big deal.
That's cool. I don't know. They do it a couple times a year, but, you know, get out there and see what your fire department's doing.
There's something for everybody.
This is over on Outer Drive, north of Michigan Avenue, Fire Station Number 2. Not the big one next to the post office here on Greenfield,
right.
This time anyway.
Right. That's from 12 to 2 p.m. a week from tomorrow. And then also, wonderful thing, the idea behind, here's the question. What if you could buy a book featuring your favorite story about living or growing up in Dearborn? Well, that's the idea behind a new project just launched by the Dearborn Historical Museum, and they want to collect 300 stories from residents and former residents, and they're publishing this book, Jay, in time for Christmas shopping. Let me just read this quote, and we'll be done with this. This is the quickest turnaround for any book deal I've ever heard, said L. Glenn O'Cray, vice chairman of the Historical Commission, who is supervising the project for the museum. We're asking people to write a very short story, about 900 words, it's kind of long, and get it to us by Thursday, October 20th. We'd like to have the book ready for sale by November 15th. So what you need to do is get this together.
Yeah, don't put this off, folks.
No.
If you've been in Dearborn, you got some great stories about living in Dearborn, write it up right now and get it off. How do they submit it?
Those interested in the project should email a story of no more than 44 lines, about 900 words, plus a title line to LGLENNOKRAY, L. Glenn O'Cray, at cavtel.net, CAVTEL.net, no later than October 20th. Or you can call for more information. You can call OCRAE at 313-724-8203. That's 313-724-8203. Get your stories in.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably just write them out longhand and take them to the McFadden Ross House at Dearborn Historical Museum, too. But they need them in the next week or so. Hey, wouldn't that be cool? Hey, there's not going to be much competition. I bet you'll get your story in.
They need them, yes.
So write it out. A story, if you've been living in Dearborn for a while and you have an interesting story about the city or maybe even Mayor Hubbard or some recollections about life in Dearborn at a certain point in time, write them down and get them over there to the Historical Museum. Here's another open house, although this one I'm not so sure about. The Combined Sewer Overflow Project, the $300-plus million project still going on in Dearborn.
Right.
They'll be hosting an open house on noon October 15th, which competes with the fire department.
Right.
Didn't somebody figure that out? So either you want free hot dogs and go to the fire department, or you're going to go and look at the Combined Sewer Overflow Project control site on Michigan Street, north of Michigan Avenue, between Morley and Exandrine. This open house will showcase the plans for the restoration of the floodplain and wetlands associated with the CSO site. Public tours will be offered, again, between 9 a.m. and noon. Oh, that's right. The fire thing starts at noon. So
right.
You can spend your whole day at open houses.
There you go. Well, yeah. Until 2 anyway, right?
Yeah. Right. There'll be a program for the CSO thing about at 10 a.m. about the importance of the CSO and controlling pollution. You're going to have government speakers, agency speakers, community partner speakers, and light refreshments will be served.
So
you get free food all day long. Go to the sewer overflow open house a week from tomorrow, October 15th, and that's Military north of Michigan Avenue between Morley and Exandrine, and then you can go to the fire department at Firehouse 2 on Utter Drive north of Michigan Avenue.
Let's hope that the sewer overflow project is not serving hot dogs. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay. Well, there's a couple of interesting comments here. We're gonna say goodbye now. Highway 61 is going to be starting in just a minute. I'm going to feature Jim Hightower just to conclude. The podcast will cut off in a minute or so. You can always go to Hightower.com also, JimHightower.com, to hear his podcast. Or you can subscribe, just like Freakonomics Radio, on the Internet at iTunes Store. So this is one. I'm just going to play one here. After the last disaster to strike the East Coast and the Northeast, the hurricane and the flooding, Republicans in Congress decided they don't really want to bail out FEMA for helping these people. And luckily things worked out. But here's Jim Hightower's comment. Goodbye for now. WHFR Dearborn. Tune in next week for an interview with one of the Dearborn Heights City
Kathy
Council
Abdel
candidates,
yep.
Kathy Abdel Huck. Take care out there.
You sold the house, act, snapped Representative Eric Cantor. Yeah, act like a petulant four-year-old. The GOP's House Majority Leader has long been a whiny, ideological brat who stamps his tiny feet in peevish anger whenever he can't get his way on legislation. This time, he was sabotaging federal aid for thousands of Americans devastated by natural disasters. Federal aid is a four-letter word to right-wing ideologues like Eric. So for weeks, he stalled the emergency funding, turning a straightforward humanitarian bill into his political football, insisting that any funding increase must first be wholly paid for by cutting spending on other public needs. Deficit purity first, people's needs last. Actually, his this-for-that demand could have easily been met if he had only agreed to cut things America definitely does not need, such as the $4 billion a year subsidy for big oil. But whoa, in Cantor world, oil giants are gods that shower manna from heaven.